Now, getting into Christmas, I don't know about you. If you have children, do anybody here do on-purpose bad dad jokes? Okay, so to warm up the crowd this morning, I thought I'd tell you a few dad jokes. Which of Santa's reindeer has bad manners? Rudolph. You can boo. I have 25 of them, so until you start laughing, they're going to keep coming. Did you know Santa has a dog? His name is Santa Paws. Someone knew that one. I heard it. Someone knew that one over there. Santa Jaws? Santa has fish. Did you know that? It's named Santa Jaws. Grab her a microphone. She's already better than I am. Do you know what Adam said the day before Christmas? Hey, it's Christmas, Eve. Oh, it is going to get worse. What does a gingerbread man? What's an elf's favorite kind of music? Wap music. It's not horrible. I even did clearly my shirt's too tight because I can't wrap my arms around the. Are you screaming because my shirt's tight or because that was good? What does a gingerbread man put on his bed? Cookie sheets. Do you know one time the gingerbread... Okay, we're done. We're done, yeah. Look to the guy to the left of you, woman to the right of you, and say hi. Say, let's get this started, okay? Okay, so what I'd like to do today is take you through a process that I went through this past week. Because a lot of times when I preach, my goal is to give you multiple thoughts throughout the sermon that can be takeaways, that can inspire you, help you overcome, and stuff like that. But today, I eventually want to get to the point where I just tell you a really long story. And maybe it's something you know, maybe it's something you've heard before, maybe it's something you're aware of. Maybe it'll help put in context the Bible, kind of the overall flow of it and stuff like that. But I'd like to tell you where I started, and here's where I started. I really wanted to do a sermon about money this morning. Okay, no amens. I figured that. Just anytime a pastor brings up money. But here's why. It's kind of been weighing on me. Do you know the number one subject that Jesus himself talked about? I know you want to say love, and the heaven and the afterlife, but do you know the number one subject that Jesus himself taught on was money? Because there was something about money that can steal our heart and affection, and this thing that we are supposed to serve us here on the earth, we eventually end up serving, and you know that you serve it, because tomorrow you have to go to work in order to pay the mortgage that you're enslaved to. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Don't hear it like that. But the reality of it is that we have to actually work for money. So instead of money working for us, that means that it could be in control of us. And so I really wanted to talk about this, especially because I was reading. So in my private disciplines, I always try to read a book outside of religion, outside of faith, outside of just the Bible. And currently I'm reading one called Atomic Habits. I don't know if you've ever heard it before. So one person. You may want to, if you need a habit of reading, you're going to want to start here, just so you know. But I was reading this, and normally in my private readings, I don't bring it to church on Sunday morning. And I hope you don't hear this wrong, but I'm doing this for me, not for you. But on this one, I read about this thing. It's Diderot Diderot. And Diderot ended up coming up with this Diderot effect that he found out that people, when you obtain a new possession, creates a spiral effect leading to additional purchases. And I got so inspired by this, and don't worry, I'm going to explain it in a second because I know I stumbled my way through it. I'll explain it to you. I started reading this, and I realized going into this month of December, most of us are probably going to fall into this spiral thing that money does during this Christmas time, because if you buy one thing for one kid, but it was $20 less for another kid, you have to somehow fill in this gap of this debt, because the kids, after you're done, are going to Google to find out exactly what you spent and make sure it's even, versus they received what they were supposed to receive, right? Like, so we have this spiral effect. And then let me tell you how this works. It basically means that when you run out and buy something, upon buying a new purchase, this guy, what happened was he was selling, his daughter was getting married, but he didn't have the money to actually pay for the wedding. So this princess from another kingdom came in and bought his entire library, which would be valued about $150,000 of today's standards. So this guy went out, paid for his daughter's wedding, and eventually bought himself a new robe for the wedding. And after he got the new robe, he realized that it doesn't match what's in his house right now, so he ended up buying a rug and a mirror. And since he had this one nicer thing, it's like everything else had to come up to that certain level. And women, you're going to be mad at me, but don't worry, I'll pick on the men in a second. You're going on a beautiful date, and you go to buy a new dress, and all of a sudden you're content with your dress, or do you realize, now I have to buy a pair of, thank you, you finished it before I said it, right? Well, and if you have shoes, you may need some earrings and necklace and gotta get your digits done, you know. So next thing you know, you buy one thing, and this Diderot effect ends up saying, listen, I need to bring everything else to match this. Men, you know, you get a new laptop or you get a new computer and you have to have screens to match. Okay, I know my audience. Let me try this one. You buy a new hunting stand. And you don't have the freshest dough pea, so you have to go out and get that. It's just what happens. We have to purchase things. And so I had this entire thought that I wanted to bring to you about this effect and tell you, like, warn you not to fall into it this Christmas. And then what I did, and by the way, this is the worst way to prepare a sermon, I then went into the scriptures to try to prove the thought that I was having. And just so you know, that's backwards. Here's what, as a pastor, as a minister, I go into the scriptures and I start reading it. And when truth comes out, I go, okay, is this truth even to the world around us? How do we see it in today's effect? So I go in there and I'm reading all this stuff about Jesus doing, talking on money and all these different sermons that he did and these parables that he did. And then I realize you guys are probably, since pretty much this month, you really only, if you think about it, you're pretty much going to get two Christmas sermons. This week and next week, then we have the kids play, and then we're going to come together on the 26th. But let's be honest, like, you guys don't want a 40-minute sermon on that one. And I know that, you know that, and we all just want to go back home and finish breakfast. And so I was like, if I only get two Sundays to preach at Christmas, why don't I, and by the way, this is my whole thought process this past week, and just kind of catching you up at where we're at. I then went, well, I know one has to do with money and gifts. It has to do with the three wise men. So I will take this Diderot effect that I want to preach on, and I'll study the three wise men and see how I can jam them together. And which, by the way, horrible, horrible, horrible ecclesiology, if anyone wants to know the fancy word for that. And so I started studying the three wise men, and man, did I go down a rabbit trail that I really enjoyed. I don't know what I just said, but this group's making me nervous over here. So I'm going to divide you up pretty soon. So I started going down this rabbit trail, and the funny thing is, I know I've preached on this subject before, I know that I've studied this subject before, but then I started thinking, how much of my understanding of this Christmas time is based on the Bible versus Christmas cards, carols, and movies? You know, I'm the one that always makes the joke, hey, your three wise men are in the nativity, they don't belong there, ha ha, but why don't they belong there? And why do we always refer to three wise men or kings? Did the Bible even call them kings? Where did this thought of that they're kings? So if it's all right with you, I just want to tell a really, really, really long story to come to eventually one single point. And so here's where this story starts. We're going to actually start thousands of years ago with the children of Israel. And you might know the Bible, and this is all review for you. If you don't know the Bible, this is an easy way. You just listen to this, because sometimes when you jump in, especially reading the Old Testament, you get lost in who's where doing what. And I'll let you know, this is a covenantal book using covenantal language to a covenantal people. But the problem was, the people weren't always covenantal towards God. And so God, at times, you would have how many remember a guy named King David? Yeah, you just went, oh my gosh, we really went way back. Yeah, don't worry, we're going to get to Matthew eventually. But you have a guy named King David, and the reason he was even King David, because two people before him, the children of Israel, started saying, we want a king. And God's saying, no, you have a king, it's me. And they're going, no, I'm looking at all these other pagan nations These other nations that are in sin, that are falling apart, that are constantly fighting, and we want what they have. We want a person here on earth that we can look to. And this prophet named Samuel said to him, you really don't want this. They're going to enslave you. They'll take your best fields. They'll tax you. Imagine this. Thousands of years ago, God was warning about government overtaxing. That was a side note. Enjoy it. And so you have, they're going to take your young men and put them in their armies and all this. And children of Israel are like, yeah, we want a king. We want a king. So they got King Saul and King David and then eventually King Solomon. But then after Solomon, Solomon had two sons, Jeroboam and Rehoboam, and they split the nation into two. You had Israel and Judah. You had 10 tribes. You had two tribes. And I'll let you know, Israel from this point on, all the kings that they had, and by the way, the answer is none. Ready? I have a question for you. Of all the kings that Israel had, how many of them were good? Man, I knew you guys knew your Bible. You're amazing. You're fantastic. And so Israel eventually, just so you know, just gets wiped off the face of the earth. The four nations come in, they attack them, they eventually pull them into their nation, and so this nation of Israel just kind of gets eradicated off the earth. But then you had Judah, these two tribes that were up north still, and they were doing okay. They would have a good king, they would have a bad king, and then eventually they weren't doing really good at all, and so God would send in these guys named Judges. I don't know if you've ever heard of them before. If not, there's a whole book, and here's your introduction to it. Children of Israel would go into some type of captivity, and God would allow these judges to come in and throw off their captors, and the Israelites would be free. And here's kind of why this was happening, because the children of Israel just weren't in covenantal relationship with their God. And so when they're bad, God let them live with the results of their bad decision, which, if I can go ahead and take a side note now, God will let you act the fool. And when you act the fool and you have negative consequences come upon you because of it, don't blame God for the negative results of the actions you originally took. Because God will stand back, if I can say this, this is going way, but this is 6,000 years ago. God will stand back in the garden and go, are you really going to eat that tomato? Oh, I'm sorry. Some of you think it's an apple. It was a tomato, because the tomato's the worst fruit ever in the history of the world. God even cursed it red like hell itself. That's not Bible. That's me. And so God will let us drink. God will let us eat. God will let us talk. And then here's, it's beautiful. The culture that God created, the economy, let me use that word. The economy that God created was actually economy of when something good happens, blessings come. That makes us want to do good more often. But when something bad occurs and curses come, ideally, like slapping a child's hand reaching for something hot, the pain makes us not want to do it anymore. This is how God's economy is all built. And so he would allow, if I can say this, for the children of Israel to get slapped around a little bit. And then he would free them, and they'd come back, free them, come back. But they got to the point where they were so toxic, they were so bad, they were so far away from this covenantal understanding of God, God allowed this Babylonian empire around 600 BC, we'll just round the number up, around 600 BC to come in and start carrying the children of Israel off into Babylonian captivity. And when I say carrying them off, because it happened in three different waves. It had three different ways. And if you ever heard a guy named Jeremiah, you've read his sentence on a greeting card before and used completely out of context. And children of Israel are getting carried off into captivity. And Jeremiah, and I know you've heard this before, he goes, the Lord knows what he has plans for you, plans to bless you and not curse you. So next time someone's graduating high school and you write that in their card, just know you're sending them off into captivity. Like that's the prophetic word that you're giving over to them. So I'm just here to ruin everyone's like theology today. So Jeremiah's like, listen, I know this is bad. I know this is horrible, but God has a plan for you. And by the way, God's plan did work. I'm going to jump forward in time and then come back here real quick. So God's plan, you had this children of Israel that kept, if I can say this, whoring themselves out to other nations. And the reason I use that term, because the covenantal language in our Bible is always talking about the children of Israel in their idolatry as a harlot. A harlot, you keep pouring yourself out to these other nations all around. And God was so interested in scrubbing this out of them, he sent them into such a toxic place that they said, we never want to be here again. And by the way, it worked so well that when you fast forward 600 years, you get this group called the Pharisees. So they went from being really wicked to being overly good. Imagine that, mankind not getting it quite right. We over-adjust where we were. And so now you have all the children of Israel, they're in captivity, and while they're in captivity, the Babylonians are trying to get the Israelites to think like they think, and so they're trying to get them to eat their food and study their books and understand that. But there was this one guy in there, and you maybe heard him before because he was in a lion's den. His name is, man, I love you guys. I knew you'd know that answer. There's a guy named Daniel, and we read about him in the book of Daniel. There you go. See, the Bible's not hard to understand. Literally labels it for us. So Daniel's in this Babylonian empire at this point, and the Babylonians are trying to indoctrinate them and scrub out this Jewish culture that's inside of them. But Daniel even got to a few points where he goes, listen, I just can't let you do this to me anymore. And I understand that you have these dietary stuff, but why don't you give me some vegetables? And after 21 days, and this is where if anyone's ever heard of the Daniel fast, welcome to it. Like, after 21 days, Daniel was actually better looking, stronger, brighter than all the people eating this pagan meat. And Daniel got so good. He got so wise. We actually see this in Daniel chapter 2. Yes, I'm about to use the Bible rather than just referencing the Bible. In Daniel chapter 2, verse 48, this is what we read. It said, then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all of its, say these two words with me. So Daniel, this Jewish boy, comes into the Babylonian Empire, and almost like Joseph in the days of old, this foreign kingdom went, dude, you're so awesome. And by the way, he probably didn't say dude or awesome, but clearly it's American coming out on you. So, like, you're so incredible. Your talents are so great that I can't just let you be a part of this slave. I'm actually going to put you in charge of all these things. So Daniel was like a Joseph in the days of old. Daniel was in charge of this foreign nation. And actually, not just for this one guy, there were three different rulers that transitioned during Daniel's 70-plus years in captivity, and all three of them kept him in place. And if you keep reading in the book of Daniel, in Daniel 5:11, you eventually see that there was like this craziness happening in the kingdom during this time. And one of the advisors says, by the way, there's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of a holy God on him. Like, we serve all, by the way, we're polytheistic. We believe in all these different gods. But this guy has the spirit about this one God that, by the way, he's rolled out rugs and he prays three times a day. When he's thrown into a fiery furnace, some friends of his, they didn't get consumed. When he got thrown into a lion's den, he didn't get eaten up. And it, like, there's this guy who has this holy God in him. And in the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom that of the gods, just like the gods. And your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, he appointed him to the chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. And another translation actually say the word magi. Those that are able to do this, like sorcery, those who have this insight. And so Daniel, this is where we kind of have to read into the scriptures just a little bit. But if Daniel's in charge of all of them, he's in charge of the nation. He's in charge of these astrologers looking up to the stars to see what the gods are up to. Do you think at any point Daniel said, let me tell you about the God who hung the stars? And by the way, they couldn't question him because everything he did was superior to them. And so as magicians, you're not saying, I don't believe in a one-two God, because at this point, that concept was foreign to all of them. You're just trying to find the highest God on the biggest mountain so you can grab the most amount of power. Daniel kept showing them this God. And so Daniel, we end up finding out this God that he keeps telling about. He eventually says this in Daniel chapter 7. You have to read this for yourself. He goes, guys, by the way, I just had a vision last night, and this empire that we're currently serving called Babylon, you should just know that it's going to come to an end, and the Medes and Persians, I'm going to name of my name, will eventually come in and overtake. And by the way, when the Medes and Persians did, they kept Daniel in place. That's how powerful he was. But that's not the last kingdom that comes in. There's going to be a Grecian kingdom that comes in after that. And then eventually a Roman kingdom that comes in after that. But when that Roman kingdom shows up in place, I should let you know now that there's going to be a king of kings born to this place. And all of these magi would have been sitting around going, oh my gosh, this is a prophecy for the days to come. This is something that still has to be untold. And then Daniel, in Daniel chapter 9, he sits them around and goes, listen, I had another vision, guys. And I had this vision of 77s. And this is a time period in which I'm talking about of these different nations that are going to be in power. But just so you know, there will be a coming of the end of the age, 77s. And I know a lot of people want to take Daniel and throw it in some distant time. But what Daniel's saying, there's going to come an end of this age of, if we would say it this way, old covenant, where we have to kill animals and go to a temple and need this priesthood. I'll give you a hint right now. You don't need me to find Jesus. I'm not your mediator. I can help communicate and translate, but if I'm the only way you ever find Jesus, I'll let you know you're dealing in an old covenant still. Get him yourself. Because it isn't my animal's blood that I sacrificed for you, it's his blood that he gave to you already. And so you don't have to come to a temple, you don't have to come to a priest, and you don't have to come to sacrificing animals. Daniel's saying, listen, after 77s, we're going to come to the time where there's this end of this age coming. And by the way, Peter, and I know I'm going real Bible nerdy on you right now. I hope this is okay. Peter and even Acts said this. This is that spoken by the prophet of Joel that Daniel was referencing. It's come to an end. We don't have to keep looking for a future king. He's here. He's here for us right now. And so Daniel would have been sitting around with all these magi telling him all about this. And then all of a sudden, Daniel dies. We don't hear anything. But we do find out about this nation, this Nabatene nation filled with magi. And by the way, this Nabatene nation, you might have seen this in movies, they were massively influential. When they would come into an area, they were so powerful that they would be able to set a king in place or remove a king from his place. And they didn't come in with conquering armies. They came in because of the astrology, because of the power, because of this almost supernatural strength that they carried. So kings were afraid of them. They actually had this place. Their capital was Petra, the rock. And I'm going to just throw up a few pictures for you, because these pictures were there, where they set up these capitals, were strategically placed. Go ahead and throw that next photo up there for me. They actually carved this out of solid rock in the mountains. This is just one picture. Here's kind of more of a landscape photo of it. They were positioned where they controlled the trade routes. And by the way, I know some people have different thoughts on who these people group were. The Nabateans is who I actually think makes the most sense. Because they created these trade routes that went from Yemen in the east, ports of Gaza, all the way to Egypt in the south, to Syria, to Asia Minor, and east to Persia. Now, right now, you just want to go, why did I give you that information? Just to show you I did my homework. That's the only reason I did this. But think about this. If you were to look at a map at all these places, this capital city that they had was found in the middle of it. And the reason they were amazing at these trade routes is because all the deserts that ran in between them, people physically couldn't move things from point A to point B. Except this group knew the secrets of the desert and all the underground water and where to find it. And would you like to know what their main trading item that they produced? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So you have these incredibly powerful people that we can trace all the way back to Daniel, where Daniel would say things like this: there's coming a day that the King of Kings will show up. And these astrologers at this time, and I know this is going to be crazy for some of us because we think we have to read the Bible to know God. We think you have to have a pastor to explain it. These astrologers were looking for the true God by looking at creation around them. Which, by the way, if you get into the Bible, it says this, that all of creation testifies who our God is. And so now let's do this. Let's do a quick pause, and let's get our Christmas reading into the sermon. Christmas reading comes in Matthew chapter 2, 600 years, nearly 600 years after Daniel sat in rooms full of the Magi. After Jesus was born, key word here, let's make sure we have our nativity scenes, Christmas theology, and Christmas carols correct. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi traveled from the east, came to Jerusalem, and asked, "Where's the one who had been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. Let's just pause there real quick. Why was Herod disturbed and all of Jerusalem with him? So Josephus was a first century theologian. By the way, he's not in the Bible. He's just he's an historian that lived during that time period that just no one questions the authenticity of his work. So he was a historian. He actually documented in 6 BC, a group of Magi came to King Herod to deliver gifts, dignitary gifts. Why is this important? Because as people in charge of the trade routes, the one thing you want to make sure everyone's happy with is you. So whenever there was a new king set in place, a new king that was born into a kingdom, it was customary at that time to bring gifts to that king to say, "We honor you, we recognize your place of authority, and by the way, stay happy with us, because we want to keep our trade routes going." So in 6 BC, we actually, because of Josephus, know that these Magi came and gave gifts to Herod. Now, Herod is on his throne. Someone comes in, rings his bell, and says, "Just so you know, the Magi are back." There's a chance he popped off his throne and went, "They're bringing me more stuff." And he's excited, nation's excited, and everyone's happy, but they're also nervous because these are the very people, by just showing up, they can dethrone a king because of their power. So are they here for good things or are they here for bad things? Well, man, look at that caravan, which we'll talk about in a minute. Look at that caravan. That stuff has some stuff on it. And they come up and King Herod presents them and he's like, "Hey, it is great to see you again. I made a spot for you in the corner for all my stuff." And they said, "We are not here for you. We are now coming with gifts to lavish upon a king of the Jews, which, by the way, to you, they're your servants, they're your slaves. And now we're coming to give this gift to this king that was born underneath this majestic star, under this heaven-testified time here on the earth. Can you tell me where he's from?" And then you see that all the people in the town were nervous. They're nervous because how is Herod going to react? Number two, how are the Jews going to react if they believe that there's a king that's going to come rally them to overthrow this Roman government? There could be an uprising on this very day just because these people arrived. And so when Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem was with him. And when he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them, "Where has this Messiah been born?" "In Bethlehem in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophets have written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who shepherds my people." And so the prophets are saying, or the advisors around Herod at this time are saying, this is what the prophets would have said. So this is where we should be looking. Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time that the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child, and as soon as you find him, report to me, so that I may too go and worship him." Let's hit pause here real quick for those who aren't familiar with the story. Herod had no desire to worship this king. Herod had a desire to eradicate anything that would take power away from his throne. And we know this because as you continue to read, after the Magi, and we'll read this in a second, after the Magi don't show back up, Herod realizes he has a major problem. So he does this. He orders for a genocide to occur, and any child under the age of 2 in all the kingdom should be slaughtered, killed, murdered. And God, aware of this, warned Joseph and Mary to go to Egypt. Now, that Egypt trip, there's a good chance we'll talk about that more next week, so I'll just put that on pause. Herod had no desire to worship the king. And by the way, there's some people in your life that you think they'll be on board with you to go find this newfound faith, religion, and understanding of God, but just be careful because there's a chance they're trying to kill the thing you're wanting to discover. And so after they had heard the king, they went on their way, verse 9, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. Can I just give personal opinion here? Can everyone hear this as this? Personal opinion. You can do a lot of studying right now. There are people, astrologers and astronomers that have done research and tried to date back. Because I don't know if you know this, God has created our world to be in a perfect order where math and science can be consistent and they can kind of go backwards of where planets and stars have moved. And there's some speculation that Jupiter would have been in order and Saturn and all these different things in place, which, by the way, very well could be the fact that there was a natural heavenly occurrence that occurred that cued to these wise men that something was happening, these magi that was happening. But when I read this verse here, that when they went to search for him, the star appeared and stopped over the house. Not manger, going to point that out to you, right? Stopped over the house. I believe that this was a supernatural occurrence that occurred in the heavens. And we see proof of that when the shepherds are all out in the field watching their sheep by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord appeared before them. And the heavenly host busted through the atmosphere and went, "Glory!" Like, I'm thinking that was a sight that you could have seen for him, a foreign country. So that, again, that's just personal conjecture. And I would say this, I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters to your faith if you think this was the moon that was really close, or an angel that was guiding them, or just a supernatural presence of God on the earth. However it is, we know this, that after they heard this, they went on their way, and a star rose ahead of them, and it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the, say that word with me, house, not manger, not nativity scene. When they came to the house, what house? The house where Mary and Joseph lived back home. Because after 40 days, Jewish law tells us that Mary and Joseph could travel again. The feast that they went to was over, and so they were back home at this point. And it could have been up to 2 years later. Why can we say up to 2 years later? Because Herod didn't have every baby 6 weeks and younger die. He said what? Every baby that is 2 years older. Tell me the exact time and place that this occurred. Well, this happened 14 months ago, 18 months ago. This happened when this star was in this place. Herod is doing math at this point and going, listen, in order to make sure that I kill this child, it has to be 2 years younger. So the magi at this point, this could have been 12, 16, 20 months later. Mary and Joseph are just sitting in their house, and all of a sudden, this group comes riding up. They came into the house. They saw the child who was with his mother Mary. They bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasure and presented him with gifts of gold. Why do we say three wise men? Gold, frankincense, myrrh. Because they gave three gifts, which we'll talk about in one more second. That's like the eighth time I've said that phrase. We'll talk about it in a second. I'll just tell you about it. And having, you know what, let's pause. I'm going to actually, let's go ahead and, I may jump back to verse 12 in a minute, if you don't mind. So now you have Joseph and Mary, they're sitting at home one day. Upon sitting at home, they start hearing a rumbling in the distance. And rumbling in the distance, they open up their shades, which they may not have had, probably didn't. They look over the horizon, all of a sudden they see a camel. They see a person. They see two. They see three. They see a mass of people come over this hill. Why do I say a mass of people? Because history at this time tells us that this group did not travel in groups of three. They physically could not because of the sheer amount of gifts that they were carrying. At this time, history tells us that if a low-level king was born, one of the dignitary gifts that you would take to them is 110 kilograms of gold, valued at $5 million today. By the way, did you know Jesus traveled with a treasurer through his whole ministry? You wonder why? Because if they actually believe, because of a prophecy that Daniel told them, not because of the Torah, not because of prophets of Israel, not because of the priests that were in a temple nearby, but because of a prophecy that they held on to for 600 years, their faith in God was more powerful than the habits of the Jewish people during that time. You think they showed up with the minimal amount of gifts that you would bring to a king that was born at that time? Or do you think the minimum is where they started? So they brought gold, which you have to beat out of a rock in order to get. They brought frankincense, that you have to bruise a tree in order to get this substance out that is cherished among the priests. They brought this myrrh, that the only way you create it is to get it crushed. And I heard T.D. Jakes say it this way. They brought broken gold for the broken king. They brought bruised frankincense to a savior that would allow himself to be bruised. They brought crushed myrrh to a man that would allow his body to be crushed to die on a cross in order for us to be saved. These are prophetic gifts that they're bringing at this time because they brought gold to the king. They brought frankincense to our final high priest, and they brought myrrh to the man that would give his self for us. And by the way, history also tells us this, that this was the big gifts that they would have brought. And you know this, mom, dad, you've had babies before, and all of a sudden people start bringing you gifts, and they bring you little infant diapers, they start bringing you saucers, they start bringing you burping cloths. One person was mean, and they bought you diapers that were made out of cloths. You returned those and got the disposable. But like, they brought you the little rocker and little thing that eventually little Timmy would be able to walk behind. These people didn't do that. They brought gifts fit for a king. And the chances that they brought rugs, the chances they brought dishes, they completely filled out Joseph and Mary's house at this point to be a fit for a king. So you have all these things that are happening right now, and Mary and Joseph in no way, shape, or form could possibly understand what is occurring at this place. But what God did, and by the way, if there was one kind of takeaway that I would love for you to hear today, it would be this. God was giving a gift to Jesus, not for where he was, but for where he was going. There's times in our life that we want God just to solve something, to fix something, to overcome something. But often, more times than not, God doesn't bring you the thing that you need for today, but he equips you with the thing that you're moving in tomorrow. You want him to all of a sudden, God, come in here and give me a new job because I need money. Give me. And he goes, wait a second. In order for you to have the job that you need, I need to give you an education that you haven't prepared yourself for. So he starts giving you the thing that you need for the life that he's calling you to. You know, rarely when my kids ask me a question about something that's happening, do I ever answer the question that they've just asked me. And usually, by the way, because of sports, it goes something like this. I hate my coach. I hate this player. I hate this team, right? And the first thing you have to do is, okay, let's take the word hate out. You know, Jesus, like, we can't hate anything ever. Like, okay, let's take that out. But then they want me to solve this problem because the coach called this play, which wasn't right. Because a kid wasn't doing what he was supposed to, and you're getting mad at him. And most of the times, rather than trying to mentor them in that moment, I start picking their head up, and I say, listen, how do you work with someone that you don't get along with? That's the skill set you need long term. So how do you motivate someone who themselves are not self-motivated? How do you encourage by climbing under or getting underneath versus climbing on top? I always try to coach them for the life lessons they need versus helping them just overcome the moment that they're in. And so often in our life, God does that very thing for us. We want him to rescue us from this moment, and he's saying this, get your head up. Get your head up, because way before Abraham was ever holding a child, he had the hope of a child. Way before David was ever sitting on a throne, he was anointed to be king where no one could see. way before Moses was the deliverer for the children of Israel, he was carrying the very staff that he needed, lost in a desert that he couldn't get out of. God gives us these things way before we're moved into the place. Nehemiah, before he ever put one brick in the wall, he had a piece of paper saying that he could. Way before Peter stood up on the day of Pentecost and said this, "This is that spoken by the prophet of Joel. I have such a revelation for it." He was standing in the courtyard going, "Nope, not my God. Nope, not my Savior. Nope, not my mentor." No, because he went through the process of rejection. When it came for full acceptance, he was able to do it because God didn't give him what he needed in the moment, but he prepared him for the place that he was sending him. So we have these magi that have now come to this house to help everyone recognize what the God in heaven was saying to them. We three kings have traveled afar with a massive caravan. And we're giving gifts in order to honor the King of Kings that have actually showed up. And what is this King of Kings going to do? He's going to be bruised for our iniquity. He's going to be beaten for our sins. He's going to be broken for our salvation. They just prophetically were giving all these things to him. And let's go ahead and do this. Let's read verse 12 real quick. "And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country in another route." In order for us to understand what God has for us today, there's a chance. And when I say a chance, let's go with 100% guarantee. God's going to have you walk a different way than you've ever gone before. There's a chance, perhaps, maybe, possibly, that the road that you always traveled is going to be one that leads to a certain result. But because of the new revelation that you have in who Jesus Christ is in your life, your road is going to shift to walk a new way. And you know, let me go ahead and throw this out in a discipleship way. And I know we have January 5th coming up where we're going to share some vision with you. But let me go ahead and give you a little teaser right now. If your life, day to day, looks the exact same as it did the day before you got saved, there's major shifting that still needs to occur. Christianity is not something that you come to on Sunday morning to get recharged so you have enough energy, you have enough strength, you have enough hope, you have enough power to be able to make it to the next Sunday. No. We're not just the recharge for your Tesla. Okay? We're not the water that you need just to get through. We're everlasting water that you can drink of at any time. And so our life as followers of Jesus Christ need to look at a way that when you wake up in the morning, you say this, "God, what do you have for me today?" Not that I need a pastor to say, not that my nav group needs to challenge me with, not that my sobriety group needs to challenge me with, not that my online coach needs to coach me about, but God, what do you have for me this day in order for me to take a new route that doesn't bring death, but it brings life? It brings life, and the reason it brings life is because I've sat with the King. And when I sit with the King, I don't come saying, "Jesus, what do you have for me?" I came with gifts. I came with myself. I came with my life. I came with my energy. I came with my passions. And I laid them down in worship before him. Could you imagine these massive, powerfully rich men come and they drop to their knees in front of the baby? And we go, "Boy, that would look weird." It only looks weird unless you yourself as a worshiper on a regular basis drops your knee before the King. And then you would say, "That makes complete sense. I don't tower over my God telling him what I need, but I come humbly before him in true worship going, I honor the brokenness that you've done. I honor the bruising that you're given. I honor the beating that you've taken instead of me. I worship you this day. Now tell me, which way does my route take me today?" Well, for the first time, I woke up and I normally get gas at this gas station. But for some reason, and I know it's higher, the gas is higher, I decided to go to this gas station today. Why was my route different? Because I went in there and I saw what looked like a mom ruffling through and she was just trying to get enough gas to get to work. And you know what I was able to do? I would say put $5 in her tank, but that didn't get her out of the parking lot nowadays. I just said, "Hey, it looks like you need a little help. God's here to help you today. Well, what's your name? Doesn't matter what my name is. I'm here today because I feel like I was supposed to come here just to pay for your gas and just to let you know Jesus loves you. Wow, that route took a different way. I normally, and this is just, I always try to go sit and not where all the families are to watch my kids' sports, but what if I on purpose took a different route to sit somewhere? And a couple weeks ago, I did this, and I found out, I said, hey, where's your wife and daughter? And the dad said, my daughter had to be rushed over to St. Louis. I knew the place. I was pointing that direction. Her knee is swollen up. It's hot to the touch. We don't know what's going on. And I, well, do you want us to take your son with us today? Do you want to go over and be with him? What can I do to help? And we've stayed in contact throughout. And it's a random thing that happens to kids at a young age. And you take some pills, and next thing you know, it's better. But because that day I chose to sit in a different route than I normally sit, I was able to actually be a blessing. And guess what? It was never about, do you want to come to my church? I actually, truth be told, I never asked him, do you go to church? Daggone, I just want to be a friend to someone. And I would think that if one of my kids are hurting and I can't go be with them, if someone else would step up and say, do you want me to take the other 18, how many do we have? Good God, it's a lot. I'm looking for full-size conversion fans at this point. Like, I would think, I have families that I could call and say, can I just bring my kids to you? Why? Because there's something about positioning yourself just to bless others. But you don't find your new routes if you've never sat with your king. And when we sit with our king and say, this is what I want, this is what I need, he's always going to say to you, listen, the gift that I have for you is not for where you are, but for where you're going. The question is, will we walk the route to get the gift that he has for us? So I don't know what your perspective on the Magi are. I don't know if you're okay with them being in your nativity scene or the Christmas cards that you read or send or the carols that you herald. Why not? At this point, this thing's coming in for a landing quick. I'm not here trying to mess up your theology. I'm not here trying to say that if you say three kings, you're wrong, three wise men, you're wrong. But I would hope, just telling this, and I know, I understand today's completely different. I just wanted to tell you a really long story. But to think that hundreds, if not millennia before Jesus ever appeared, God was whispering. And then to a pagan nation, God placed a man because the Jewish people just were not going to understand what had in front of them, but God was going to make sure his son was given the gifts of a king. For them to come, and by the way, if you study history, the Nabataeans nearly disappear after this is over. Historians can't tell us what happened to them. There's no major battle that wipes them out. The only thing left is a story in a Bible and some etchings in a rock. But what if they played the part just to honor the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords? And so today, God, I'm okay with not having a major takeaway, life lesson. I'm okay with not having the three steps to righteousness, prosperity. Because Jesus, on this holiday, I'm okay of just talking about you. I'm aware that you most likely were born in the springtime and not December 25th, but I honor our forefathers that hundreds, actually more than that, thousands of years ago, they recognized that the virgin birth was being lost in the story, and they knew that this was a pivotal piece to actually confirm who you are. So they set aside a holiday. They redeemed a pagan day and said, this is the day that we're going to honor the King of Kings. So God, this holiday, we honor you. And I pray we do not do it because we get sucked in this downward effect of having to spend more and more money. But God, may we honor you with the simple gifts that we give to someone else. May we honor you because when we receive a gift, we understand that you yourself on this time period were in a place where you were able to. May we during this time period not get lost in the glitter, the lights, the decorations, the movies, the holidays, and the songs. But may we remember that through a virgin you were born King of Kings. And today, God, I thank you for the gifts that you give us, not the ones in our hands, but the ones that prepare us for the days to come. We love you, Jesus. If you agree with that, say amen. Amen.